Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling one of those huge questions, you know? What does it actually mean to be alive?
Yeah, it sounds simple, but it's surprisingly deep.
Absolutely. And we're diving into some fascinating lectures by Dr. Ty C. M. Hoffman to really get to the bottom of it. Hopefully, we can give you some, well, surprising insights and maybe a shortcut to understanding biology's
That's
foundations.
the plan. Dr. Hoffman, he's just brilliant at cutting through all the complexity. He really boils biology down to its core concepts.
So our mission today is to pull out those key nuggets from Dr. Hoffman's lectures. We want to help you understand not just what life is, but how it works, how it adapts, how it's all organized,
From the tiniest molecule.
all the way up to, well, the whole planet, really, ecosystems. So let's jump in.
Okay.
Dr. Hoffman starts things off with what seems like a simple challenge. How hard is it really to define life?
Right. And he suggests it's actually much easier to just recognize something that's alive by its characteristics than it is to try and write some short, neat dictionary definition.
Okay, that makes sense.
And he simplifies everything in the universe, literally everything, into just three categories to start. You've got living things, then non-living things, like, say, a rock. It's never been alive.
Right, never alive.
And then third, dead things, like a corpse. It was alive, but isn't anymore.
Ah, that's a key distinction, isn't it? Non-living versus dead.
Exactly. It clears up a common point of confusion right away.
Okay, so recognizing is one thing, but for defining it, what's Dr. Hoffman's approach? What are the criteria he lays out?
Well, he identifies six major characteristics, six things that all living things have in common. And here's the crucial bit. To be considered alive, something must have all six.
All six. Got it. So non-living things might have, what, one or two, maybe?
Precisely. Like a crystal might seem to grow or even reproduce in a very loose sense, but it fails on the other characteristics completely. That really drives home the all six rule.
Okay, so what are these six essential traits then? Let's break them down.
First up, response to environment. Every living thing reacts to its surroundings. Even a simple bacterium does. The response might just be, dying if the environment gets hostile, but it's still a response.
Okay, makes sense. Reacting, what's next?
Reproduction.
Yeah.
The ability to make more of your own kind, produce offspring.
Right, the crystal example fits here too. It doesn't truly reproduce biologically.
Exactly. Then there's growth and development. And Dr. Hoffman points out these aren't quite the same thing.
Oh, how so?
Well, growth is basically just an increase in size. A bacterium gets bigger before it splits. We grow by adding more cells. Development, though, that's about the changes during a lifetime. Think about it.
Yeah.
We start as one single cell, a zygote, and develop into this incredibly complex adult human with, what, something like 100 trillion cells?
Wow, 100 trillion.
And they're all specialized, liver cells, brain cells, blood cells. That's development.
Incredible complexity. Okay, now, this next one you mentioned from Dr. Hoffman really caught my attention. Energy processing. He says, life is metabolism.
Yeah, it's a powerful statement. It really is. What does he mean by that? It's not just something life does, it is life.
Basically, yes. Metabolism is the sum total of all the chemical reactions happening inside an organism, thousands of them. And he emphasizes that the cell is the fundamental unit of life because it's like this tiny container.
Little test tube.
Exactly, like a little test tube isolated from the rest of the universe where all this chemistry, all these reactions can happen in a controlled way. That constant chemical activity is the essence of being alive.
Okay, wow. So if life is all that chemistry, there must be incredible control involved,
Yeah?
which leads to the next point.
Precisely. Regulation. Living things have to be able to control all those thousands of reactions, turning pathways on or off as needed. It's absolutely vital.
Right. And all this controlled chemistry allows for structure, order.
Yes, the next characteristic, high degree of order. Living things are incredibly organized structures, from molecules up to whole organisms. And Dr. Hoffman makes the point that this order isn't free.
Ah, it takes energy to maintain it. A significant amount of energy, yeah.
Yeah.
Which ties right back into energy processing or metabolism. It's all connected.
There really is a loop. Okay, and the final one.
The sixth characteristic is evolutionary adaptation.
Adaptation. So changing to fit the environment better.
Kind of. It's about changes that lead to a better fit, or, biologically speaking, increased fitness for a particular environment. But here's the key distinction Dr. Hoffman stresses.
That's that.
Adaptation happens at the population level, over generations, not within one individual's lifetime. You, personally, don't evolve during your life. populations do.
Okay, population level. So how does that actually happen? What's the mechanism?
Dr. Hoffman really focuses on natural selection, Darwin's big idea, you know. It's a primary mechanism how evolution drives adaptation.
Right. Survival of the fittest, sort of.
Well, it's more like reproduction of the fittest. Individuals who happen to have genes that give them an advantage in their current environment are more likely to survive and reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
And they pass those advantageous genes onto their offspring. So over time, the population, on average, becomes better suited, better adapted to that environment.
But environments change.
Constantly. Yeah. Which is why Dr. Hoffman notes that perfect fitness is kind of an impossible goal. It's a continuous process of adaptation.
So it's not about individuals trying to adapt. It's the environment selecting traits over long periods. That's a really important clarification. Okay, let's circle back to a question Dr. Hoffman brings up early on. That classic biology question. Is a virus alive? An organism?
Yes. And his answer is very clear. No.
No. Why not? They certainly affect living things.
They do, but they fail his criteria. Specifically, they lack the absolute bare minimum requirement being made of at least one cell. A virus, as he puts it, is really just a couple of molecules. It can't reproduce on its own. It can't metabolize on its own. It basically hijacks a living cell's machinery to do those things. It only interacts with life by changing how an organism functions when it's present.
So it doesn't meet the all six criteria fundamentally because it's not even a cell.
Exactly. It really highlights how precise these biological definitions need to be.
It really does. Okay, so we've got a working definition of life based on these six characteristics. But how does life organize itself, all this complexity? Dr. Hoffman talks about a hierarchy, right?
Yes, a hierarchy of biological organization.
Yeah.
He describes it as a kind of nested arrangement like Russian dolls, where bigger things contain smaller things.
Okay, walk us through that. Where does it start, biologically speaking?
Well, fundamentally, it starts with atoms forming molecules. But in biology, we often start looking at organelles. These are like the little organs inside a cell.
Like mitochondria, the powerhouses.
Exactly. Mitochondria, ribosomes that make proteins, the nucleus in some cells. Those are organelles.
And organelles inside.
Cells, the fundamental unit of life, as we discussed. And for single-celled organisms, like bacteria, the cell is the organism. That's the highest level for them.
Right. But for us, multicellular types.
It gets more complex. Similar cells group together to form tissues. Dr. Hoffman points out the four main types in vertebrates. Epithelial tissue, like your skin or linings. Muscle tissue. Connective tissue, like bone or blood. And nervous tissue.
Okay, cells make tissues, then tissues make
organs. Different types of tissues working together for a specific job form an organ. Think of a plant leaf, or your liver, or your heart. Even skin is an organ.
Got it. And organs work together, too.
Yep. That gives us organ systems, groups of organs cooperating, like the digestive system or the nervous system or the reproductive system.
And all those systems make up the
individual organism. You, me, a tree, a fungus.
Okay, so that's the individual. But biology doesn't stop there, does it?
Not at all. We move beyond the individual. A group of individuals of the same species living in the same area is called a population.
Right. A population of squirrels in a park, for example.
Exactly. Then, if you take all the different populations, squirrels, pigeons, oak trees, bacteria, living together in that park, that's a community. Importantly, it's only the living things.
Okay, community is just the living stuff.
Correct. And here's Dr. Hoffman's key distinction. Add the non-living components to that community. The air, the water, the soil, the sunlight, and now you have an ecosystem.
Ah, okay. Community plus the non-living environment equals ecosystem. That's clear.
And the very highest level.
The whole planet?
Pretty much. The biosphere.
Yeah.
He calls it the hollow sphere of life around Earth. From deep in the crust to high up in the atmosphere, everywhere life exists.
That hierarchy really puts things in perspective, from organelles to the biosphere. And Dr. Hoffman uses this, doesn't he, to explain some fundamental processes, like how energy and materials move.
Yes, exactly. He makes a crucial point about ecosystems. Energy, he says, flows through an ecosystem.
Flows through, like a river.
Sort of. It usually comes into sunlight, gets captured by plants, transferred when things eat other things, transformed along the way, and eventually most of it leaves the ecosystem as heat. It's largely a one-way trip.
Okay, energy flows through and out. What about materials, like carbon, water?
Materials or matter? They cycle within the ecosystem, more or less. They get used, rearranged, reused. Think about carbon dioxide being taken up by plants, becoming part of the plant, maybe being eaten, respired back out as CO2, and then used again.
So energy is a one-way street, but matter kind of sticks around and gets recycled.
That's a great way to summarize it.
Okay, fascinating. Let's shift focus a bit now to the architecture of life, the cells themselves. Dr. Hoffman discusses a fundamental split, right? A dichotomy of cell types.
He does. He introduces the two basic kinds of cells, prokaryotic and eukaryotic.
And the names mean something.
They do. Karyo refers to a kernel or nucleus. Pro means before. So prokaryotic means before the nucleus has evolved. Eu means true. So eukaryotic means having a true nucleus.
So the big difference is the nucleus.
That's the main historical distinction, yes. Eukaryotic cells have a true nucleus, meaning their DNA is enclosed within a membrane. They also have other membrane-bound organelles like mitochondria, chloroplasts, and plants, etc.
And prokaryotic cells.
They lack a membrane-bound nucleus. Their DNA is just located in a region called the nucleoid, but it's not enclosed. And crucially, they also lack those other membrane-bound organelles. They basically just have an outer plasma membrane, ribosomes, and the cytoplasm inside.
So if a eukaryotic cell is like a big house with lots of different rooms for different jobs.
Then a prokaryotic cell is more like a one-room studio apartment. Much simpler structurally. Everything happens in the same main space, the cytoplasm.
And they're different sizes too, right?
Oh, vastly different. Prokaryotic cells, bacteria and archaea, are typically much, much smaller. Dr. Hoffman notes you could probably fit about 1,000 bacteria inside a typical eukaryotic cell.
1,000 inside one of our cells. That's mind-boggling.
It really puts the scale into perspective, doesn't it? How much complex machinery is packed into even one of our cells.
Definitely. Okay, so these cells, prokaryotic or eukaryotic, they form the basis. And this links to cell theory, doesn't it?
Yes. The core idea Dr. Hoffman emphasizes from cell theory is fundamental. Cells come only from pre-existing cells.
Meaning no spontaneous generation of cells.
Exactly. Every cell on Earth today is the result of an unbroken chain of cell division stretching back billions of years to the very first cells. Whether it's a bacterium splitting in two or that single zygote dividing over and over to make a whole human, it's always cells from cells.
An unbroken lineage for billions of years. That's quite a thought. Okay, so cells are the units. What about the stuff they're made of? The building blocks, macromolecules.
Right. He highlights four crucial categories of large biological molecules, macromolecules that all life uses. Most are polymers, meaning long chains made of repeating smaller units.
Okay, what are the four?
We have proteins, which are polymers made of amino acids, then polysaccharides, which are large carbohydrates, polymers of simple sugars like glucose. Third are lipids, fats, and oils. And finally, nucleic acids, which are polymers of nucleotides, and that includes DNA and RNA.
And Dr. Hoffman puts a special emphasis on proteins, doesn't he?
He does. He makes the point that it's the proteins that primarily carry out the functions of the cell and therefore directly determine an organism's traits.
How so? More than DNA.
Well, DNA holds the blueprint, the instructions, but proteins are the actual workers, the enzymes, the structural components. DNA gives you your traits indirectly, he says. DNA codes for RNA, and then RNA codes for the specific sequence of amino acids that makes a protein. It's the protein shape and function that give you brown eyes or allow you to digest milk or think.
Okay. DNA is the ultimate source code, but proteins are the functional output that makes things happen.
Got it.
And DNA itself, that famous double helix.
Yes, he describes it visually as that twisted ladder structure.
Okay, fantastic. So we have the building blocks and the basic units. Now let's talk about keeping everything running smoothly, maintaining balance. Dr. Hoffman uses the term homeostasis.
Yes, homeostasis, literally meaning staying the same. It's about maintaining a relatively constant internal environment despite changes in the external world.
Like keeping our body temperatures steady.
That's the classic example. Yeah, body temperature is a variable. Your body has a set point, about 98.6 Fahrenheit or 37 Celsius. Homeostasis involves mechanisms to keep your actual temperature close to that set point. The difference between the actual value and the set point is what he calls a error.
And minimizing that error is crucial for survival.
Absolutely critical. If internal conditions drift too far, cells can't function properly and the organism can die.
So how do organisms do that? How do they maintain that balance? What are the mechanisms?
Dr. Hoffman details two main types of feedback mechanisms involved in regulation. But, and this is key, only one of them actually achieves homeostasis.
Okay, which one is that?
Negative feedback. It's called negative because its job is to negate the error, to reduce the difference between the actual state and the set point.
So if you get too hot, negative feedback cools you down, and if you get too cold, it warms you up.
Exactly. It always pushes the variable back towards the set point, reducing the error. He gives a great biochemical example, like a metabolic pathway, where the final product inhibits the first enzyme in the pathway.
So when there's enough product, it shuts down its own production line.
Precisely. That prevents too much from accumulating.
Yeah.
That's negative feedback at the molecular level, constantly fine-tuning things.
Okay, so negative feedback is the key to stability. What's the other type then?
The other is positive feedback. And unlike negative feedback, positive feedback always makes the error worse. It pushes the variable further away from the set point.
Further away? That sounds dangerous. How can that be useful?
It is dangerous if it goes on too long, which is why positive feedback loops must be temporary processes that have a specific endpoint. They never lead to homeostasis.
Okay, so what's an example?
The classic one Dr. Hoffman uses is childbirth. The hormone oxytocin stimulates uterine contractions. These contractions stretch the cervix. That stretching sends signals to release more oxytocin, which causes stronger contractions, which causes more stretching.
Ah, a reinforcing cycle.
Exactly. It amplifies the process, pushing it forward rapidly until the end point, the baby being born. Then the stretching stops, oxytocin levels drop, and other mechanisms, negative feedback, restore balance.
That makes perfect sense why it has to be temporary. Okay, so we've covered definition, organization, building blocks, and regulation. What about the sheer diversity of life? How does Dr. Hoffman connect all this back to understanding the millions of species out there?
He connects it through the concept of shared ancestry, which is the basis for how we classify life. He touches on taxonomy, the science of classification, which uses that hierarchical system we discussed earlier. And he emphasizes the broadest categories, the three domains of life.
The three domains, what are they?
These are the highest ranks encompassing all known organisms. They are bacteria, archaea, and eukarya.
Okay, bacteria and archaea. Those are both prokaryotes, right? The simple cells.
They are both prokaryotic in structure, yes. But Dr. Hoffman stresses that despite looking similar under a microscope, they have very significant chemical and genetic differences, especially in their cell walls and membranes. That's why they're in separate domains. They diverged very early in life's history.
Interesting. So there's no single prokaryote domain.
Correct. It's bacteria and archaea as distinct prokaryotic domains. And then the third domain, eukarya, contains all organisms with eukaryotic cells, plants, animals, fungi, protists. That's our domain.
Got it. Bacteria, archaea, eukarya, the three fundamental branches of the tree of life. Now, to wrap things up, Dr. Hoffman also offers some really valuable thoughts on the process we use to gain all this knowledge, the scientific process itself.
Yes, this is crucial. He draws a very clear line between science and other ways of knowing. Science, he insists, is fundamentally based on evidence. Testable, observable evidence.
And if there's no evidence,
then it's not science. He contrasts this with faith, which he defines as belief without evidence, and sometimes even despite contrary evidence, a completely different realm.
And what about scientific facts? Are they absolute truths?
He addresses that too. Things we call scientific facts, like gravity or evolution by natural selection, are concepts that have been tested repeatedly and have consistently held up. They have overwhelming supporting evidence. But science always holds open the possibility of revision based on new evidence. Facts aren't absolute, unchanging dogma. Think about how Newtonian physics was a great model, a fact, for centuries, but then quantum mechanics and relativity came along and showed it was incomplete at very small or very large scales. Science refines its understanding.
So it's a process of getting closer to understanding reality based on evidence. How does he illustrate the method itself?
He uses a really simple everyday example, a flashlight that doesn't work. It perfectly illustrates the steps.
Okay, let's hear it.
First, the observation. The flashlight isn't working. That leads to a question. Why isn't it working? Then you formulate a hypothesis. This is a potential explanation stated as if it were true, and often using the word because, for instance. The flashlight isn't working because the batteries are dead.
Okay. Observation, question, hypothesis. What's next?
The hypothesis leads to a testable prediction. This usually takes an if-then-will format. So, if my hypothesis, dead batteries, is true, then if I replace the batteries with fresh ones, the flashlight will work.
Makes sense. If A, then B will happen.
Right. And the final step is the experiment. You actually replace the batteries and see if the light turns on. You test the prediction.
And the outcome of that test is really important for how science progresses, isn't it? Dr. Hoffman had a key insight here.
Absolutely crucial. He points out what happens based on the result. If your prediction does not come true, you change the batteries, and the light still doesn't work, then your hypothesis, the batteries are dead, is refuted. It's been proven wrong, or at least incomplete.
Okay, so you can disprove a hypothesis. What if the prediction does come true, the light comes on?
This is the critical part. If the prediction comes true, the hypothesis is not proven true. It is only supported or bolstered.
Not proven. Why not?
Because there might be other reasons why the light came on. Maybe the bulb was loose, and changing the batteries just happened to reseed it correctly. So a successful prediction strengthens our confidence in the hypothesis, but it doesn't provide absolute proof.
Ah, okay. That's why scientists repeat experiments and test things in different ways, to build up that confidence.
Exactly. The more different predictions from a hypothesis hold up under testing, the more confidence we have in it, until we eventually might call it a theory or even a scientific fact. But always with that underlying principle that it's based on evidence and open to refinement.
Wow, what an incredible tour. We've gone from the most basic chemical definition of life with Dr. Hoffman all the way through its incredible organization, the mechanisms like feedback and evolution, and right into how we even know any of this through science.
It really is a comprehensive framework he provides. You see how all these concepts, cells, metabolism, genetics, evolution, ecology, they aren't separate subjects. They're all deeply interconnected parts of understanding life itself.
Absolutely. And maybe a final thought for you, our listener, building on Dr. Hoffman's ideas. Just take a moment to consider that elegant simplicity he described the cell as just a tiny contained test tube where the chemistry of life happens. Then zoom out and think about how billions of these microscopic test tubes are working together inside you right now, constantly regulated, constantly interacting, adapting over evolutionary time, creating this astonishingly complex being that is you living within the entire biosphere. What does really contemplating that intricate energetic balance suggest about the sheer wonder, the fragility, and the resilience of your own life every single second?